have higher rates of dying from COVID-19, the vaccine can actually save our lives. Not only save your life, but save the life of your family members. And so when people have a hesitation around taking the vaccine, again, you should consider, what are the benefits of me taking the vaccine versus the risk of me getting or having long-term effects of actually getting COVID? And once you consider that, once you've talked with your doctor, then make a decision of whether or not it's okay to do it now.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB Stony Brook. It's 6 o'clock on a Tuesday. Time for Off the Wall. Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yep.
It's quite a day, huh?
It's always a quite a
it is
day.
We say that a lot, but sometimes history is at the door, and I think this is one of those days. just is. We'll get to that in a second. But boy, what a tournament this was. Euro 2020.
Incredible.
In 2021. Delayed a year, but from start to finish. You probably didn't hear much about it in this country, but it really was amazing. 24 countries from various parts of Europe starting out, and it ended on Sunday with the final between England and Italy. And I got to say, I was... I never know who to root for. I don't have, you know, dogs in this race or whatever the phrase is. I basically am won over throughout the course of the month that the tournament takes place. And from the beginning, Italy won me over just in their method of play, their attitude, their positive attitude. And England kind of did the opposite. A couple of reasons. This Euro competition was spread out throughout Europe. Not just in one or two countries. It was as far out as Azerbaijan. It was in the Netherlands. It was in Italy. It was in France. It was in the UK. Problem was, the English team played virtually every single one of their games at Wembley Stadium in London. No one else had an advantage like that. So it's not really that surprising that they made it all the way to the final, because they had a fierce home team advantage in almost every game, except for one. So that right away kind of turns me off. I don't like things being handed out. But then I saw the behavior of the fans, and it was atrocious. It was awful. They would boo the other team's national anthem. Nobody else did that. Nobody else. It was horrible to see, you know. You play the national anthem of the guest team, then you play the national anthem of the home team. In these competitions, it's very stirring, it's very emotional, but to have something like 40,000 plus people booing during the national anthem of another country just didn't sit right with me. And that's another thing, 40,000 people, what they've been doing in the UK is just gradually increasing the number of people they're allowing into these stadiums despite the health risks. You know, they're not there yet. They've made progress, but they're not even opening up the country until the 19th. But they kind of pushed back and started letting more and more people in. So it was 40,000, which was more than was expected. Then it was 60,000, and they said that would be the cap on Sunday. But no, it was more like 75,000. They just let more people in. So that didn't sit too well. But then the overt racism of the English fans just put me over the top. Basically, the English team has always taken the knee. And, you know, taking the knee is something that extends well beyond American football in this country. It's worldwide. And what the British team, to their credit, has been doing, along with some other teams as well, is basically taking the knee. Not during the national anthem. People are saying that, and it's not correct. After the national anthem, before play begins, every member of the team takes a knee on the field.
It's the very last thing they do as they take their positions there.
It really is, and it's good to see that kind of unity, and that that's basically taking a knee against racism. You couldn't be more pure than that. And oftentimes, the other team joins them. Not every time. And we saw ugliness in Budapest when one of the games was being played in Hungary, where mobs of people were demanding that the teams not take the knee. You know, basically, we want racism or something crazy like that. So that made me root against Hungary, you know, who I was originally for. But when I see that kind of ugliness, you can't support it. So what happens in England, the British players, their own team, take the knee. They boo them. They're booing their own team for standing up against racism. I mean, how can you support something like that?
At a certain point, it's not nonconformity for the sake of nonconformity. It's straight up racism.
Absolutely. Unapologetic racism. It's
both feet firmly planted in that camp.
Yeah, yeah. It's like people on that side don't care anymore. You know, it's similar to what we're seeing in this country and probably in other countries as well with the anti-vaccine movement, where basically people are saying, yeah, I'll get sick, maybe I'll die, but at least I won't take the vaccine. It's like, you know, anything but follow the advice of somebody who knows what they're talking about. You know, they're taking a stand that makes absolutely no sense. All right, and that's why I call them pro-virus people, because they are pro-virus. they're doing nothing but promoting the spreading of it. But that's another topic. So, okay, so we had the game. A great game on Sunday between Italy and England. England took the lead in the first half, 1-0, and then Italy equalized in the second and went to extra time, which is 30 minutes, two periods of 30 minutes each, basically an opportunity to break the tie. No golden goals. I used to have those where you score and you win. Now you have two 15-minute periods. Even if you score in the first 15-minute period, you still have to play the second one. And then at the end of extra time, if you're still tied, it goes to penalty kicks. I never liked that. I never liked that being the way to decide a match, or especially a championship. But what are you going to do? You can't keep playing on the field. You're going to have more instances of people with cardiac arrest, which is another major milestone of this tournament, when Christian Eriksen collapsed in the first game Denmark was playing in Copenhagen. My God, what an emotional day that was in Copenhagen, in his home city. The Danish national team, and you saw the humanity there, how everybody cared so much about what was happening and so little about the actual game, and how he started to recover and really inspired his team to move ahead. Unfortunately, they didn't progress into the final, but I certainly would have rooted for them. Penalty kicks. Some people got them and some people didn't. And when I saw this happening, I saw the three English players miss or have their penalty kicks blocked. All three of them were black. And I said, uh-oh. I know how this is going to go. I know how it's going to go because of the racism of the English fans. And it did. It certainly did. They have been subjected to the most horrible racism in forums like Twitter, Facebook, and in real life as well. For what? For playing for their team, for missing, for having the goalkeeper of Italy block their kicks. It's so disgusting to see this, and everyone now is finally paying attention to it and saying, yeah, you know, and they were booing the national anthem of the other team as well. This is unacceptable behavior. At one point, they were shining a laser pointer in the Danish goalkeeper's eyes during a penalty kick in a previous game, and running onto the field, fireworks that you know, they're not supposed to be having, breaking into the stadium without tickets. And basically what the Football Federation does is fine the British Football Association, because it's their responsibility to manage their fans. And when they don't do that, it's on them. And conversely, or as an extension of that, the Football Association in England fines local teams if their fans can't control themselves. So it's different than what it is in the States, where, you know, everybody is just pretty much acting as individual. Teams take responsibility for their fans, and they're held accountable.
And pubs, they're hooligans.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You get 86th if you were part of this. That's what I hear. You can't get a drink now.
Well, anyway.
How about the fact that those players were so young, too? Imagine all that pressure. And that, again, points out the racism just in your recounting of it. Like, how the stupid conclusion is, oh, it's because they're this or that. It's not that they're young players given an opportunity, trying their best, and being under a ton of pressure. All that other talk when it comes to Mikkelsen and the heart and overtraining or mental issues, somehow that's no excuse. They have even more pressure and expectation because, well, they have to match up to whiteness as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really backwards.
Well, I rooted for the right team. I did.
So did I.
I'm so happy Italy won. Just their positive attitude, and just God, they play well. Just watching the footwork was a joy in and of itself.
So incredibly technical the whole time. Not a lot of those, even in the second half. There was a couple of moments in the second half where it got a little looser, but they were very calculated and taking the ball up the field to get it into the like goal territory and, and I don't know the exact terms, but anyway, they would really like, they wouldn't do these like long passes where, oh, I'm just gonna go for broke and get it as far as I can, a lot more like what you see in American football when they're trying to throw it to somebody. This is like small plays up the middle, a lot of that, like I just love seeing just the beauty and the tactics or just the passing quality, just how tight they were as
they
a team.
And credit to the British goalkeeper, because he defended very, very well against them. And the British team, they're younger, they're more forceful, so they would push back up into the Italian side. But then the Italians would get the ball back and just methodically get back into British territory. And, you know, they take their shots and they'd be blocked, but they just kept trying over and over again. They did not back down, and it was just one of the best games I've seen. And unfortunately, to have it marred in this way is just so typical of the ugliness that surrounds us. There's a football player named Tyrone Mings, and he has accused the Home Secretary in the UK of pretending to be disgusted by racist abuse after she previously criticized the act of taking the knee, calling it gesture politics. Well, it's a gesture, but I'd hardly say it's politics. I'd say it's humanity. It's human rights that people are standing up for. And if you believe human rights are a political act, I don't think you understand what human rights are. Basically, he said to the Home Secretary, her name is Priti Patel. Priti, that's her first name? Priti? I'm not really sure how to pronounce that. She said she was disgusted by the online abuse directed at the trio, the three black players who missed their penalty shots, Marcus Rashford, Bukayo Saka, and Jadon Sancho. Tyrone Mings said was on Twitter, "You don't get to stoke the fire at the beginning of the tournament by labeling our anti-racism message as gesture politics and then pretend to be disgusted when the very thing we're campaigning against happens." And that's it. That nails it. And the same thing for, you know, Boris Johnson, who refused to criticize the racists, the people who were making the game so ugly, and then acting all befuddled and confused. Why are these people doing the thing that I refuse to condemn them for doing? Basically, he doesn't get it. So many people just don't get it. It's not hard. It's not really that much of a sacrifice, you know, to stand up against this sort of thing. So, it's more than football, that's for sure. It's definitely a course in civics and history and race and all that.
Whole lot of lessons learned. Those individuals in particular, I hope they see how they appear in this moment.
Yeah, yeah. So here's an interesting piece related to this concerning the Irish take. Okay, Ireland, as you may know, you should know, is a separate country, not in the United Kingdom. Northern Ireland is, but the Republic of Ireland, the bulk of the island, is not. Now, this affects them. The UK's behavior affects them, and here's why. And this is from a piece that appeared on IrishCentral.com. As England's hopes of lifting Euro 2020 faded with the missed penalties against Italy, so too did Ireland's prospects of hosting the World Cup in 9 years' time. The Football Association of Ireland is preparing to table a bid to host the biggest sporting event in the world alongside England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. However, any chance of World Soccer's governing body awarding the prestigious event to the UK and Ireland has now gone up in smoke following the disgusting behavior of English fans over the past 4 weeks. England's run to the final of Euro 2020 has been marred by English supporters who have embarrassed their country on the international stage. London's Wembley Stadium hosted both semifinals and the final of the Pan-European tournament. Why? Why did they get to host so many games? I don't get that. Both semifinals and the final, plus so many games before that. Big mistake allowing them to do that. It should have been spread evenly throughout the continent. It should have been a joyous occasion for English football. Rather than being remembered as a perfect finale to a thrilling festival of soccer, and it really was thrilling, Wembley will now be remembered for hundreds of ticketless hooligans breaching the stadium's perimeter, attacking innocent fans, and openly taking drugs. There were reports of racist and xenophobic chanting, of a defenseless steward being punched in the face, open cocaine use in front of young children inside the stadium. It's like an episode of Shameless, the British version, as hundreds of ticketless thugs overran security and made their way into the ground, while many supporters reported being intimidated out of their seats. There were at least 53 arrests, and 19 police officers suffered injuries. It was a dark stain on what has been a celebration of soccer over the past month, but it was hardly an isolated incident. It goes on. We could talk about this for the rest of the hour, but I think you get the point. Ugliness. It has its terrible consequences, and it affects so many innocent people, both directly and indirectly.
And it mars a lot of the clubs and teams and spectators and efforts at not having this kind of thing.
It really
makes the game, it's a blemish on the experience in general for families or people who are really just passionate about the sport itself.
Yeah, there's so many good people both on the field and in the stands that don't deserve this, that don't deserve to be labeled in this way. And it's just sad. It's sad to see that. But enlightening, educational. So what do you think of the Texas lawmakers? They basically have...
They went on a field trip.
They escaped. They escaped Texas.
Well, that's fled.
They
nasty.
Fled to Washington. Well, it's true. They fled to Washington, D.C.
You're right.
Yeah. And they did this so that the Republican bill that basically limits voting rights is delayed, if not stopped altogether. Everyone knows there's very little that can be done to stop the Republicans from ultimately passing their ugly bills. And what Governor Abbott is saying is that he's just going to keep calling special session after special session forever until he gets what he wants. But Democrats are able to hold them off for now, even though they're being threatened with arrest from Texas. Now, according to Chris Turner, who's the Democratic leader in the Texas State House, he says, best I know, Texas law enforcement doesn't have jurisdiction outside the state of Texas. Furious Texas Republicans sought today to pursue other means of retribution. What, are they going to attack their families? I wouldn't put it past them. Abbott threatening to detain the lawmakers as soon as they return to the state. Other GOP leaders warning they might remove Democrats from leadership positions in the legislature. This, to me, is what we need. This is an act of courage, something that might inspire other people to do similar things, to finally fight back against the crap that's been going on over the past few months with all these voter restriction laws that are being passed by Republican legislatures, simply because they lost. They lost the election. They can't handle it.
Can't even admit it, can't accept it, can't get over it.
Today, President Biden forcefully reiterated his desire to pass federal voting legislation and lashed out at Republicans for seeking to make voting harder and to make it easier to challenge the results of future elections. Have you no shame, he asked. We must pass the For the People Act. It's a national imperative. But how does that get done when the filibuster is sitting there blocking everything from happening? Something has to give. There's absolutely no question. Something has to happen here for this to change. It has to change. There is no question about that. And more actions need to be taken like these Texas legislators. Acts of courage can inspire people. Now, will it inspire Joe Manchin to finally back down and allow things to get done? Who knows? Maybe. It's possible. You're shaking your head. You're doubtful. I'm doubtful, too.
He is a part of all the favors that got called in by the minority leader.
Mm-hmm. It appears that way. But you have to put the pressure on. You have to do dramatic things. And you have to annoy the other side. You have to call them out on every opportunity.
Harder. Play harder ball.
Yeah, absolutely. Stop being polite. Stop being the way you want everybody to be. Because if you're the only one being that way, it doesn't do any good whatsoever. So,
I think this is the right subject to be focused on, though.
It absolutely
is. It affects everyone, and it's so fresh in everyone's mind. Mm-hmm. This mysterious thing we call voting and campaigns. And I think the experience was so memorable in all kinds of ways that when we look at it retrospectively and especially in the face of these sort of faux in examinations and faux recounts, I think that alongside this parallel restrictive legislation, it's quite evident that the subject voting itself needs bolstering, needs attention, needs advocacy. Yeah. And that's something pretty much everybody can get around, because that's the process itself. It's an operational critique that we ought to be engaged in. And I welcome the conversation. I think there's a lot of other priorities, a lot of things that are not getting addressed. And, but this has to be the focus now, because so many people that came through and stood in those lines, mm-hmm. they're depending and counting on others to stick up and shine light on this issue.
Yeah, and make no mistake, those are the people affected by this. People who live in comfortable areas where it's easy to vote, they're not affected by this at all. But the people who have to really work hard at it by throwing more monkey wrenches into the works, by making it more difficult, making it more uncomfortable, what you're basically doing is persuading those people not to bother. And make no mistake, that is what the goal is. There are absolutely no indications of a problem with the voting process. It worked. It just didn't work the way they wanted it to. More people showed up and voted against them. They don't like that, so they want to prevent that from happening. And they prevent that from happening by figuring out, who is it that voted against us? How do we make things as hard as possible? Let's only have one polling place for this million amount of people. That'll make long lines. Well, let's make it illegal to give people water who are standing on long lines. You know, you basically just ratchet it up, and eventually you'll get the desired outcome where a large number of people simply will opt not to do it. You make it hard for people to vote by mail or absentee ballot, or you make these crazy penalties. If you do something wrong, if you forget to sign something, you go to jail. All sorts of things to intimidate people. And it's never the rich people you're intimidating, because, you know, they're taken care of. They never have to worry about this. It's the poor people. It's the people that, you know, maybe have never done this before. They're the ones that are going to just say, you know what, I'm going to sit this out and just let somebody else deal with it. That is how you take control, by casting others out. It's, you know, you don't have to use fire hoses. You don't have to, use cops to physically prevent people. There are other ways to do that. And that is what they are pursuing right now. There is no other way of interpreting this. There was not a problem. Why is this being done everywhere? Ask yourself that. If you support this kind of thing, why? Why is this necessary when there were no indications of fraud, other than what people are conjuring up, such as the Arizona recount, which everybody knows is nonsense? Even Republicans are saying this is nonsense. It's happened before. There have been recounts before. They have not found any issues. And the only way you can create an issue is by saying there's an issue. So it's basically creating your own facts to suit the agenda that you want to see play out.
Well, they're not facts. They're
it's creating facts. No, they're not facts.
They're not the focus. The focus is expanding access to the polls to get out there and get more representation, to stop gerrymandering, as well as campaign finance. We really need to take the dollars out of the kind of fundraising we're seeing.
There's a lot we need to do.
It's fine, you know, like I said, fresh and front of mind for so many right now. That's fine if it's nothing else is gonna get through, then we can work on this together. And I think that coordination, supporting the Democrats in states that are being attacked right now, where the vote itself is being attacked, where election workers themselves are having their lifestyle, their integrity questioned.
Their families are being threatened because they work as poll workers or in the election
Board or people something. Didn't like the outcomes
this is
that
insane.
Were found and approved qualified or whatever it is accounted officially.
We have to stop
blaming individuals. They're blaming individuals for a process that played out, including the audits, and they're not satisfied until some audit tells them something they want to hear, which is wrong. That's not how it works.
Right, and we cannot back down on that, and we cannot give them equal time as if their particular version of the truth is valid. You know, if facts prove you wrong, you don't get to keep saying that your facts prove you right, because your facts aren't actually facts. And we have to stop falling down this rabbit hole, because I keep seeing people that have no business saying things being given an equal platform to people who have devoted their lives to being experts in the field. You know, I'm talking not only about elections, I'm talking about the virus as well. You know, it's I know we want to see debate. I know we want to see conflict, but that's not how you do it. You know, you basically find people that know what they're talking about who disagree with each other. And that's where you have the debate. Okay, not just anyone off the street that wants a particular outcome that will say anything. All right, on to the virus. Well, it's happening pretty much as we said it would. And when we say things like this, when we go on the air and we say, you know, if people don't get the vaccine, the rate of infection is going to start increasing. Well, people haven't been taking the vaccine in certain places, certain states. And guess what? The levels of contagion are going way up, way up. How do you continue to hold on to the position that these facts don't add up? The vaccine protects you against the virus. Why do we have to say this? It is so obvious. It is so clear. What is the point of saying that it's worth getting the virus? I don't get it. I really don't get it. It's like some kind of insane like drug has been put in the water or something. The daily positivity level here in New York has surpassed 1%. That's across the state for the second day in a row. Actually, this was yesterday, so it could be 3 days in a row. What that means is it's spreading. You know, for every one person, 1.1 people now have it. And so that's a number that's going up. When it's below one, then it's dying out. When it's above one. And the thing is, with the vaccine being so readily available, it should be getting towards zero by now. You know, we shouldn't have to worry about this anymore. And the only reason we are worried about this is because people haven't been taking the vaccine. There is no other reason.
So true. The simple fact is getting as many people to break that chain of transmission from person to person, especially when restrictive stuff being in close proximity is more prevalent when the distancing requirements are fewer and far between, and masking and so forth is less and less common in confined spaces, these transmission chains will continue to proliferate across like public transit, the stadium scenarios, all that kind of bars, like social gathering where people are just thinking things are just fine, and in many cases they are, but they're with pockets of people that are not participating in vaccination. There are chances that when you're in those spaces, there's a lot of people that just haven't got around to it. Maybe they aren't in an eligibility group, depending on the country you're in. And
no, wait, in the country, yeah, but not in this country. Anybody can get it now, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm speaking a little bit globally, just but you're sure there are many options. And even assuming everybody who is eligible does, there is still many valid reasons. There are individuals who may not be vaccinated in your proximity. So mm-hmm. you have to account for that. Like, that's part of why trying to keep your distance still is a good idea, especially because of the unknowns and factors like people who are immunocompromised or otherwise have not participated. Yeah, we want to account for those mm-hmm. people who are choosing that. But rationalizing that you're not at risk because the restrictions are gone, that's not something that makes you eligible.
Right.
And I think that's exactly the kind of attitude that's emerging at precisely a time when we're seeing variations come up. I think it was England that reversed quickly some of opening.
England is
oh, they're the opposite.
England's going full throttle ahead like idiots. Netherlands is going back to restrictions because they opened too fast. I think the French are as well. There's a bunch of countries that just opened up too quickly, and now they're feeling the effects of it.
That's right. You mentioned Netherlands, and the figures I read, I think it was like 2,000 cases 1 week, then 4,000, and so that was the indicator. I think it was a Times article talking about some of the changes there in changing guidelines quickly to respond to basically 2 weeks later seeing a lot of cases.
And the thing that really gets me is seeing these reports from hospitals, and you see the the doctors basically talking to the media and saying all these people are in the hospital now, some of whom are in very bad condition, and almost all of whom are so regretful that they didn't get the vaccine when they had the chance. They can't now because they're in the hospital. It's not going to help them. But they had the opportunity. They turned it down, and they are filled with regret now. And this is just happening over and over and over again. We might not be seeing it so much here, fortunately, in Nassau and Suffolk area, but it's happening. And there are too many people that are spreading false narratives around that are encouraging people to act this way. And I consider them guilty of leading people to their doom. And they should be held accountable for that. Spreading false information when it results in someone's death, I think is a crime. I think it is a very serious crime.
It shouldn't be a fun hobby.
Absolutely not. So that is something that you need to call out every time you see it happening. Otherwise, it gets stronger. Otherwise, it spreads, like the virus itself. Yeah, there's a strange parallel there. Okay, statewide, 73.3% of New Yorkers aged 18 or older have received at least one COVID-19 vaccination shot. That's actually pretty good. 61.1% of the total population have received at least one shot. That's good, but numbers continue to rise, and that's because there are people who have not gotten the vaccine yet for unclear reasons. Now, here's an interesting story. I saw this just for a moment on a site called The Motley Fool, which I don't usually read, but I just it pissed me off because I just saw this headline go by. It said, could Pfizer and Moderna be in trouble after the latest COVID vaccine findings? Maybe, but it's still too soon to know for sure. Here's the issue. The vaccines could potentially provide immunity for years, according to recent findings. Years. Extended protection against COVID-19 could significantly cut into recurring revenue for Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna. Yeah, that's when I just walked away. They care about their bottom line. They care about their revenue. And the fact that the vaccine is too good is going to hurt them. And we're supposed to feel sorry for them? I'm sorry. I'm sorry that people feel that way. And if any of you think for one second that we trust these companies, no, we never trusted these companies. And here's an indication why. Because they care about their profits above all else. But does that mean that we don't trust that the vaccine works? That's science, okay? That basically is provable science. Does it work? Does it not? Apparently it works too well for the companies that made it. So, yeah, you know, we support the vaccine. We don't support this kind of nonsense where they basically are saying, oh, poor us, we're going to lose money because people are going to be immune for longer. And then, literally the next day after this story, after I saw the story anyway, Pfizer suddenly said, you know what? People are going to need a booster. People are going to need a booster in a few months. Yeah, that's it. People are going to need a booster, and that'll save our bottom line. That's basically what they did. So, yeah, they will pull all kinds of shenanigans. Now, if the science supports that, if the science says, okay, the vaccine is wearing off, you're going to need a booster, then I will believe the science. I am not going to believe Pfizer PR, ever. Never did. And you shouldn't either. But just to see a headline like that, that they're concerned or that anyone is concerned that it's going to hurt their revenue because people will be protected for years, that tells you quite a bit about the motivations.
Sure. And the publication may itself be a little bit more focused on the business side of it or investment side of it.
Yeah,
and I think they are a finance publication, but regardless, in the context of the emergency use and the pandemic itself, I think it's just it's foolish, and it's not really practically speaking what I think the promise of the technology that Pfizer has developed and put into practice holds. There are a lot of other therapies and uses, and there will be probably a lot of competition to continue to develop this for infectious diseases as well. And it may be the marketing or PR people at Pfizer were just maybe not on their game and a little bit more focused on what they're dealing with a lot of right now, which is in particular this COVID-19 vaccination and all that it entails. But I don't think it's going to be like the defining pharmaceutical for this company forever. So, I mean, to think that they're somehow in trouble, quote unquote, just because they made something that's of high quality, I think that actually speaks more for what's possible for them, you know, to create and market in other realms, just like I said, because they make something that is effective and safe and really doing a lot for society in general in response to this disease.
We don't usually do this, but we're going to play a PSA in the middle of the show.
I first got the vaccine, number one, as obviously to protect myself, but honestly to protect my family. I've had direct discussions after getting the vaccine with members of my own family, and I think in general there was just kind of overall skepticism, especially in the Black community, but in Black and Brown communities alike. There are historic health inequities, and so there are reasonable concerns from members of those communities. That's a community that I belong to as well. And that's why I had to inform myself and look at the data myself. The data was very reassuring. And one thing for me as a Black American was seeing how diverse the patient population was in each trial and feeling comfortable with that as well. There is lots of misinformation in the media, and it's hard to combat that. And so I would go with trusted sources, medical professionals, people in your community, people in your family, ask about their experiences and get familiar.
And don't listen to Fox News, all right? She didn't say that, but she meant it. Listen to people know what they're talking about. It doesn't necessarily mean us either, you know? Just listen to the people that devote their lives to this kind of thing.
And your doctor.
Yeah, your doctor.
Start there.
You know how many, I've seen a lot of doctors. Not that there's anything really wrong with me, but I've gone through a bunch of things in the last year that just involved everything from dentist, you know, to general practitioners. And I had my kidney thing a couple of weeks ago. And,
well, a lot of things were deferred and because of this whole...
I even saw a cardiologist, because it was the thing to do. There were a few others, too. But every single one of them said the same thing, that people aren't taking this seriously enough, that they know so many people who have died, and then not even people that work in emergency rooms, you know. And I hear this from other people throughout the country. We're lucky here. At least you and I are, because I don't think we know anybody who is actually in our circle of friends passed away because of this, but there are so many people who have 600,000 plus. And I don't care, you know, what kind of criticism you have towards various political leaders. You have to hold the ones responsible, you know, who didn't take this seriously, who didn't take enough steps. People like governors of Florida and of Texas and the president of the United States last year, who didn't take things seriously and allowed so many people to die who did not have to. They were not all 95 years old. They were not all 400 pounds. They were not all unhealthy. No, a lot of them were in the prime of their lives and otherwise completely healthy. Not that it makes your life any less valuable if you aren't healthy or if you're old or anything like that. Didn't have to happen to anybody. You know, we had the knowledge to prevent this. And there are too many people in power that chose not to allow that to be shared. And it's disgusting.
Yeah, think of that. It was a matter of, I don't know, convenience or inconvenience, to avoid the inconvenience of taking responsibility, of saying, look, party's over. Mm-hmm. This isn't a joke. This isn't about politics, but rather taking the opposite stance and saying this is all politics and lusting after that power so much that you're willing to sacrifice so very many people. So, and you could have lifted up the people that were raising alarm, mm-hmm. raised with the power of the presidency and put focus on it immediately and wrangled the CDC to figure out how to do their job.
I just saw this story. This is disgusting. This is exactly what we're talking about right now. And it's tantamount to murder. It really is tantamount to murder. Tell me how it's not. This just happened. The Tennessee Department of Health will halt all adolescent vaccine outreach, not just for coronavirus, but all diseases amid pressure from Republican state lawmakers. They will halt all adolescent vaccine outreach for all diseases, not just coronavirus, after pressure from Republican state lawmakers.
What about
what the hell is wrong with these people? They want everybody to die? I don't get it. Why do we listen to them? Why do we let them do this to us? And why do we put them on an equal level with others that we are also unhappy with, like Cuomo and de Blasio? And yeah, we're unhappy with everybody who's elected, but some of them are so much worse. Some of them have real blood on their hands. Here is an example. It just happened. Damn.
It's like being stupid woke.
Yeah.
It's like we want to be down with people that don't immunize, so therefore we're going to set the tone for everyone.
Listen to this. It's like I'm in bizarro world here. The health department will take steps to ensure it no longer sends postcards or other notices reminding teenagers to get their second dose of the coronavirus vaccine. They're going to basically make an extra attempt to make sure they don't remind them to be healthy, get the damn shot.
That's like the one class that absolutely need reminders for things like that.
These changes take effect just as COVID-19 shows new signs of spread in Tennessee. I mean,
it's negligence. It's criminal negligence.
I love Tennessee. We saw the eclipse there. Great people. But, you know, if you don't want the reputation of dumbasses, get these people out of control. You know, don't let them stay in power. The test positivity, remember we were talking about the test positivity rate here, just going over 1%, which is troublesome. Well, it jumped in Tennessee from 2.2% to 5.4%. That's what's happening. Disgusting.
It's negligence. It's really, you gotta ask yourself, these are our leaders? I mean, there's better there, I'm sure. There must be people that really care.
Yeah, leader used to mean somebody in the front, you know, the best of us. Can you imagine worse than that? I don't get it. It's like stupid is now something that we strive for. I wonder, is there something else going on? Is there another virus out there that is affecting the way we think? I'm at a loss for words.
I was reminded in some of this sort of stuff we're noticing sociologically speaking, and I once talked about this when asked to describe people that are into computers and hacking and subcultures that I'm pretty familiar with, and I think this goes as well for society. I mean, as any citizen or a group of interested citizens would have it, you can be a part of a community and of a group and still think individually. You can think for yourself.
Absolutely.
And act as a group. And that means in parties, nationally, in your city council, wherever it is, in your affinity group, your neighborhood, in your household. It does not mean necessarily because you are looking out for other individuals or you're thinking about the larger government and what it can possibly provide in its functioning. We are able to remain on our own, autonomous, individual, and mm-hmm. and have our beliefs and still functionally cooperate. And I think that's been lost.
Right. Always ask questions. You should always be, you know, free to ask questions, always feel comfortable asking questions, but, you know, accept the answers and don't try and twist the truth to meet whatever agenda that you want to have. This is bothering me so much. I want to finish with something positive because, we sure need that. Remember the train we took up to Schefferville in Quebec through Labrador?
I do.
The native train that was bought for $1 by the native people there that basically is the only way to get to Schefferville by land unless you take an airplane from somewhere else.
It's a lifeline.
It's a great train.
It was really cool, and it had all kinds of customizing, and I was, love it. I got great photos
it's
of it.
You do. It's in the, show them up, to show them to the audience. It's in the news. The Canada Infrastructure Bank and the Quebec government have invested $55 million in the, I can't pronounce it. The
Sichuan.
Sichuan. Wait, that sounds Chinese. That's Sichuan. No, it's, how do you say it? It's spelled Sichuan.
I know it's not how it's spelled.
Sichuan.
See, we haven't heard someone refer to it
they
in so long.
They gave me a hat. I wear this hat all the time.
No, but we haven't spoken to anybody there.
That's true.
That's why we haven't
heard
it.
We only spent a few hours there. We had to come right back down because otherwise we had to stay there 3 days.
We'll go back
I wish we had stayed 3 days now. I really do. And it's the first place I want to go.
We'll go back just to figure out how to pronounce it.
The goal is to modernize the infrastructure, build new stations, and purchase new rail cars. Yeah, LIRR should be as lucky. This railway runs from Sept-Îles on Quebec's North Shore through Labrador and to Schefferville, 530 kilometers away, transporting both passengers and merchandise and Pee Wee hockey teams sometimes, which was the case when we were going up there. Boy, it is also the only way residents of Schefferville can reach the rest of the province by land. You know, it's hard to buy a ticket. It's a challenge, but it is so worth it. It's a long train ride, but I heartily recommend it.
Some of the important stuff is adding stops and probably shelters. I'm sure there'll be along the line of the kind of hunting huts and small structures, but they don't have any very many like official designated stops along the way. They have stations on each end. The other thing they're missing is a station near the actual town. You have to go across town,
right?
From where?
Well, I don't think that's going to change. They are going to add a station to a place called Malietanum, which is an Innu community on the southern part, east of Satil. But they're owned by the Innu Nation of Matamakush Lac Jean.
Yeah, that's what I meant on the one side of town. Because you remember it took like 15 minutes just to go from one side of the town because we were a little confused.
And we didn't know we could do it either because there were no taxis. And we actually, the owner of the hotel that we were staying at for a few hours drove us, which was great. That's a kind of small town thing they have. Other news, very quickly, Amtrak has signed a mammoth contract with manufacturing company Siemens Mobility for 83 new train sets, part of a $7.3 billion plan to update its rolling stock over the next decade. Some of the cars right here on the East Coast are over 50 years old. So every week it seems like there's more progress being made in rail in this country, which is great. We could have spent more time talking about that, but I'm thrilled. I'm happy that we're finally seeing this taken seriously. And that maybe there will be some improvements in the years ahead. But we have to support it. We really have to support it. And that goes for commuter rail. That goes for mass transit within cities. That goes for light rail in the suburbs. And it goes for long distance train service.
The more interest people take, the better the result, because the input, the feedback, the right kind of familiarity with the locales and the expertise is that much better because you deliberate.
We are out of time. Hey, let's go out with some Gigi D'Agostino to honor the Italian team. We will be back next week. Stay tuned for Finn, OTW at 2600.com.
Grappa.
Grappa for all. Oh, absolutely.
Viva Italia.
Yeah. Can't wait. See you next week. Good night.